Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me today is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
Before we begin today's show, I want to introduce everyone to the new website that you have,
yes.
Father, and I'll let you introduce that because it is phenomenal. I got a chance to look through it again this weekend, and it is just really exciting.
Great. Well, it's very simple because we decided just to go with my name, so it's all one word, nothing capitalized. It's Michael John Witt. W-I-T-T, and it's MichaelJohnWitt.com. And I keep telling people I really wanted to have MichaelJohnWitt.gov, but they wouldn't give me my own government agency. So it's MichaelJohnWitt.com. And if you have a modern computer, you can get on it right away. The one that I have at the rectory takes about 45 minutes to download a 55-minute program.
Okay.
But newer machines...
Depending
can
on
do
what
it
kind of, if you
in
have
a matter
DSL
of seconds.
Or whatever, too. It's pretty quick.
Yeah, and it's just it's very interactive. You have an opportunity to go to Catholic Encyclopedia and get more information on the topics that we're talking about, and the timeline is timely, and so we're still working on it, but I'm real excited about it.
I am too. I think it's just beautiful, and looking forward to finding out what's going to go in the bottom two categories on the front page. There's the two sections at the bottom say upcoming.
Oh, I didn't realize
that.
Well, I've got one set already. I just
okay.
have to put it together. It's going to be an interactive project on Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I think that would be really good to do that.
Oh, I'd love to have that. Yeah, that'd be great.
And I don't know what the other one is yet.
Okay, so good.
Yay.
That's exciting. All right, now back to the show.
Okay.
What are we going to cover today, Father?
Well, we're going to cover the end of the Cold War, the end of the crisis, the nuclear crisis that we've been talking about for so many weeks. And last time around, we did a real quick run over of the different technical means that were introduced in order to try to bring about a safer world after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
But as Pope John the 23rd mentioned in Pacementeris, that ultimately the one thing that had to change was the hearts of people. And interestingly enough, what we're going to see by the end of this program is that three people take the bull by the horn and change the world. And it's going to be through hearts. And those are, of course, Pope John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. and Mikhail Gorbachev. And we'll talk a little bit about each of them and their role in the 1980s and how that comes about.
Great.
Okay. So as I said before, there were all kinds of technical means that were introduced. You had the hotline agreements so that you'd have instant communication between the U.S. and Soviet leadership, limited test ban treaties, outer space treaties, treaties that declared nuclear-free zones, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was a very important treaty that unfortunately has been broken any number of times, seabed treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention, all of those sorts of things, threshold test ban treaties so that you couldn't fire off a nuclear weapon that was stronger than 150 kilotons, which is still a pretty powerful weapon. And then finally, you entered into, with the Nixon administration, we entered into real negotiations with the Soviet Union toward the limitation of nuclear weapons and ultimately the ending of the escalation. It's going to be a while before you have the de-escalation take place, but the ending of the escalation. And this is really the result of a lot of negotiations that go back to as early as the 1960s. So we're really looking at the Johnson administration entering into discussions. And in 1964, there was a proposal made in a committee known as the 18-Nation Disarmament Committee. And these 18 nations met in Geneva. And their mandate was this, and I'll quote from their mission statement, you could say, okay, to explore a verified freeze of the number and characteristics of strategic nuclear offensive and defensive vehicles. So that's what they're set up to do. Ultimately, however, there was nothing came of this. 18 nations met together, and you still have the continued progress along the nuclearization of the world. The Chinese, the People's Republic of China, exploded a nuclear weapon. Around throughout those late 60s, you had the Soviet Union plant anti-ballistic missile systems around Moscow. These are those systems that are going to attempt to shoot down missiles. That is defeated, of course, ultimately by the invention of another nuclear step forward, technical step forward by the United States in the multiply targeted reentry vehicles, those MIRVs, you know. You have the United States in 1967 itself considering the possibility of an anti-ballistic missile system along the West Coast. The concern was one against China. But that, of course, would be a that would also be a threat to the Soviets. And so you just have just all kinds of difficulties. And then in 1968, during the election season, of course, the election of 1968, the Johnson administration walked out of the talks in Geneva, the 18-nation disarmament committee meetings, because 1968 also was the year that the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia. And so he did that by way of protest. Well, of course, the election of 68 went to Richard Nixon, and Nixon showed right from the very beginning a sense of the importance of solving the strategic problem. And so what he did was, within 2 weeks of taking office, he contacted the Soviets and offered to begin bilateral discussions, which ultimately would lead to the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, the SALT One and SALT Two. This is important to do right away, because the fact of the matter was that by the late 1960s, now we talked before about the number of nuclear weapons we had. Mm-hmm. Well, we were continuing to build those at the rate of about 200 a year.
Wow.
You know, like as if we needed anymore.
Yeah, right.
You know, but yeah, you had that. The Soviet Union had increased, while they were talking, had increased the number of submarine-launched ballistic missiles by 400%.
Wow.
You know, the United States was continuing to harden its silos so as to be able to take a near-direct hit from a nuclear bomb. At the same time, the Soviet Union was increasing what they call throw weight. That is to say, the size and the strength of their own nuclear weapons. So things are getting worse, not better. And so it's only by May of 1972 that you have a real attempt at freezing this, at stopping this. And basically it's the treaty is signed between Richard Nixon and Leonid Brezhnev of the Soviet Union. And what they did was they froze the number of delivery systems. And then they introduce something that is very important, and that is what they refer to as the National Technical Means of Verification. A national technical means is basically a legalized spying.
Okay.
So each one is going to set up what's called a standing consultative commission, which would talk about verification modes, like, for instance, listening posts. And I'll talk a little bit later on about how important that is. Also, you have visitors that will be coming to various nuclear sites, both from the Soviet Union to the United States, from the United States to the Soviet Union. Certain spy activities would be allowed, like, for instance, the flyovers of satellites. Now, remember that there had always been this incredible tension about spy planes flying over. Remember Gary Powers and the U-2 incident back in the 50s. And so this is now going to be allowed. And the technology has now come to that point to allow this to happen. There are regular fly patterns around the globe on the part of satellites. And there are other satellites that are what are called geosyncopated. What that means is that they actually stay as the Earth turns. They actually stay with the Earth, and so they're taking a constant picture. These things are 25. If my notes are right here, it seems incredible. I've got it that they're 25,000 miles out in space. 25,000 miles? Well, maybe so. Anyway, they're way out in space.
Yeah.
And all you need is about five of them to cover the entire globe.
Okay.
And then there are others that are closer that take pictures and of specific areas, and these would then drop parachutes down back into the atmosphere, and planes would come by and snatch these things up, and then the pictures would be developed. It's just absolutely phenomenal.
Oh,
and this
God.
Was the 1980s. You know, we've gone digital since then, and
uh-huh.
we're much better than what.
Don't have to rely on the parachute anymore.
Yeah, right. You know, and these things can see. They can sense heat, as in rocket launches. They can sense flashes. In fact, it was sometime in the 1980s or 90s, I think it was the 80s, that there was an incredible flash that was discovered or seen in South Africa. And all of a sudden, the world woke up to the fact that the South African, this was the apartheid government now, was developing a nuclear bomb. A very scary thought. And we talked a little bit earlier on about the International Atomic Energy Committee. And here's a case in which the IAEA, Energy Agency, came in to South Africa and said, okay, guys. And the South Africans cooperated beautifully with the IAEA, basically showed everything they had, and then allowed it to be dismantled. And in fact, they did about the same thing that Muammar Gaddafi this past year did
uh-huh.
with the Libyan program that was
right.
Set up. And there's one in which it worked. In fact, there were South African scientists who had offered, this was before the Second Gulf War, had offered to go to Iraq and meet with Saddam Hussein and show him how to dismantle the nuclear program, which we all thought existed, peacefully. And he refused to let them in. I think he was bluffing or something, but so we didn't, you know, know. But South Africa did that successfully. It happened because a U.S. satellite had seen,
had spotted
the flash. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's quite extraordinary when you think of it. And all of this was conducted by an agency called the National Office of Reconnaissance, which is part of, it's an office within the United States Air Force.
Okay.
Under the guise of the Pentagon, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the interesting thing. I mean, you know, for conspiracy buffs and things like that, there is no public directory listing for this office of reconnaissance. They have no phone and no address. You know. Well, these are the technical means that are used in order to verify, and the IAEA used these and then went beyond this so that countries that had nuclear programs could be monitored. And things like, for instance, something they call the Big Brother black boxes. These were devices that were put into nuclear facilities,
okay.
mainly of third world countries, because there was a movement ever since the 1950s. Eisenhower believed that if you introduced nuclear technology to third world countries in a peaceful way, it was a program called Atoms for Peace, that if you did it in a peaceful way, that they wouldn't hanker after nuclear bombs, but rather nuclear energy. And unfortunately, that was not entirely... Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the greatest failure in that program was Pakistan. India and Pakistan, both of them ended up with weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea was that if you had a nuclear facility, you'd have these black boxes, which would be sealed, but inside the box itself would be monitors. And then every once in a while, a representative from the IAEA would come and then take those out, those recordings, and then they would study to make sure that they weren't doing anything bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was one. Audits of reactor logs, things of that, those sorts of things, taking an accounting of the materials that were used, whether these were enriched uranium as opposed to buying the enriched uranium from a legitimate country, whether they were making their own, all those sorts of things. You know, the whole issue of yellow cake uranium, which is stuff that needs to be processed, and you know, the purchase of all of those are all telltale signs as to whether a third world country was trying to get into the nuclear club or not.
Okay.
And this is very current because North Korea has, within the past year or so, kicked out UN inspectors,
right,
which meant that they dismantled the Big Brother black boxes and, of course, don't allow the auditing to take place anymore. That's a very, very dangerous thing. Also, we're dealing with Iran is in the process of soft peddling its situation too. Well, what happened was that, you know, the first nations to introduce these will be the United States and the Soviet Union. By 1979, both countries agreed that there would be 9 black boxes that would be put into their facilities, and that there would be inspections between 3 and 4 sites would be inspected each year. And in the end, the Soviet Union balked on that, refused to allow it until 1982, and then they finally agreed to it, which was the same year that the United States refused to allow the inspections to take place. So this whole thing about verification is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other ways that the now of course at this point all these inspections are open. We've made a big change on that. But there were all kinds of ways also to find out whether or not these if someone was cheating. And an example of this, years back, it was in the late 80s, I attended a conference concerning a lot of these matters, and one of the scientists who was involved in the nuclear and missile programs in the United States said that there was a real crisis that had happened at one moment in which I guess it was President Reagan had gotten a phone call from the Soviets, and they wanted to know what was going on at this particular silo out in, Minot, North Dakota or something. I don't know where it was. But anyway, he said, well, I'll find out. And so he called, his people called out to find out, what's going on out at Minot. And they said, well, nothing. And they said, well, the Soviets are complaining. Now, how would they know what's going on with a satellite?
Mm-hmm.
And a satellite had taken a picture, and it showed that a nuclear missile silo had been opened up.
Okay.
Now it's open. That's like, loading a gun.
Uh-huh.
That's right. And they wanted to know why.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was more complicated than that, because what happened was that a great big tarp, one of those blue tarps, was placed over the silo so that you couldn't tell whether the doors had been closed again or they were still open. And the Soviets wanted to know what's going on there. Well, anyhow, the long and short of it was the scientist telling a group of us how tense this was at the moment. They sent somebody out to find out what was going on. What happened was it was the middle of the winter. This is North Dakota. It was very, very cold. And these mechanics were repairing some of the valves in the silo, and they complained that it was cold, and so they put the tarp over. Yeah. And so anyway, the U.S. called back to the Soviets and said, well, this is what's going on. And the Soviet response was, it's cold over here, too. Take that tarp off. And we did.
And we did.
And so those poor guys had to work in freezing North Dakota weather, but
it's true. It is probably a lot colder over there in places where some of theirs are.
Yeah, and it just shows you. Now, this is the 1980s, but it shows you the sophistication
of the watching.
Of watching, yeah. Remember President Reagan's famous trust but verify,
right.
Trust but verify. There you have an example of that. Another thing, too, is underground test. How do you know that somebody has tested underground? And the argument could be, well, they could claim that it was an earthquake. How do you know? Well, the fact of the matter is that seismologists know the difference,
mm-hmm.
because the thrust that takes place, the force that's released in an earthquake is like parallel because it's
the shifting of the rock.
Yeah, that's right. The plates. Remember the plate tectonics, and so you have a parallel shifting that's taking place. In a nuclear explosion, you have an epicenter, and then the force goes out. The waves go out in all directions. So you can't get away with that one either.
Okay.
You know. So there you have all of these technical means, and they're going to make us safer, but they're not going to make us safe. Mm-hmm. We're still living in a mutually assured destructive society. Then what happens is these three guys come along in the 1980s. And it's sort of set up. You have, for instance, in 1973, there is a meeting that takes place called the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And what happened was that the Soviet Union was invited to attend. In fact, all of the countries of Europe were invited to attend, and they were looking at stabilizing and normalizing borders. Remember we talked back during the Second Vatican Council, Cardinal Wojtyła was one of the Polish bishops that had encouraged a letter to be sent to the German bishops accepting their apology for atrocities of the Second World War and then also apologizing for anything that they might have done and recognizing the new borders as permanent. Well, this idea was to do the same thing all throughout Europe. For centuries, there had been arguments and fights and wars over border disputes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In 1973, you have an organization that's set up to stabilize that. Invited, as I say, was the Soviet Union, and also invited was the Vatican. This is the first time the Vatican has been invited to an international conference to be a member of an international conference since 1815.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that something?
That is.
Yeah, and it shows the importance of Vatican policy and foreign policy, which becomes a real key in the solving of this Cold War dilemma. What this ends up being, ultimately, is the Helsinki Accords.
Oh, okay.
You know, and these are signed by each of the member countries in which they uphold the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And this is incredibly important that all of these nations recognize this. They are allowing themselves to be held accountable to those human rights standards. And that's a major move forward, especially for the East Bloc countries. Now, of course, they didn't exactly follow. It's going to take a while, but the application is. At the same time, you have Pope Paul VI really pressing the envelope on human rights, really pushing the envelope there. You have his encyclical, Populorum Progressio, and then a letter that comes out a little after that, Octogesimo Adventiens. Okay. And these are both of these will be key to Vatican foreign policy, because the Vatican foreign policy under Paul the VI is going to be toward human rights, human dignity, social justice, and that's going to be the keystone of his foreign policy. That's parallel to the shift that takes place in American foreign policy after 1976, because there you have the 4 years in which Jimmy Carter served as President of the United States, and there's a shift in American foreign policy toward human rights and social justice issues also. And so this is, I think, an important aspect. Always remembering at the same time the failure to apply this. Remember that Cardinal Wojtyła has quite a serious critique of Ostpolitik on the part of the Vatican. So there's a certain naivete even as they're looking at the ideals. There are critics, of course, of the Carter administration saying the same thing, that it's incredibly naive to go into a world using this as the criteria. This is the ultimate goal, but whether it should be the strategy or not,
yeah,
that's right. We're dealing with humans and not angels. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, you know, he sets very clearly, I'm talking about Jimmy Carter here, sets very clearly a proactive stance in an address right after his election at Notre Dame University. The president said the following. He says, "We can no longer separate traditional issues of war and peace from the new global questions of justice, equality, and human rights." That had to be music to the ear of Pope Paul VI. He goes on and says, "We have reaffirmed America's commitment to human rights as a fundamental tenet of our foreign policy. We want the world to know that our nation stands for more than financial prosperity." So you really do have a parallel foreign policy of these two states, the Holy See on the one hand and the United States on the other. In order to cement this, President Carter sent over what was referred to as a personal representative to the Vatican. We had not had formal relations. The United States had not had formal relations with the Vatican since the Second World War. And this individual goes over. He is not official. It's a personal representative. So it's not part of the State Department. It is an unpaid position. And it's also part-time. So, you know, it doesn't show a lot of commitment on the part of the United States in this. But all this is going to change. The policies are going to change, the personalities are going to change, the relationship's going to change with the change of leadership. In 1978, you have the election of Pope John Paul II, Cardinal Wojtyła, the critiquer of Ostpolitik. Okay? He's going to become the Pope. Mm-hmm. Also in 1980, you have the election of Ronald Reagan. Very different approach to the world. He understands the world very differently from Jimmy Carter. And then later on, we'll see Gorbachev coming in as a third element of this. But both of these men share a number of things in common. I'm talking about Pope John Paul II and Ronald Reagan. And at the root of all of this is an incredible loathing for communism. And they see what communism is and what it does, and both of them on an ideological basis are opposed to it and want to do something to destroy communism as a force in the world. There is going to be a shift now in Vatican foreign policy that is going to be the greatest shift since Pius XII. Remember, Pius XII had a very anti-communist position and an alignment with the West. That changes with John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. With John Paul the 2nd, it's going to be another shift, and there's going to be a coordination of the Vatican and the West, particularly the United States. Interesting, very interesting. In 1982, the United States sent a trial balloon to the Vatican about the possibility of a visit by President Reagan. This is the first time in the history of the United States, the first time in the history of the Vatican, that a sitting president would visit the Pope. And this is a big deal. And so it's set that in 1982 the visit would take place. 6 months before the visit took place, in Poland, the communist government cracked down on Solidarity. And began disrupting the Solidarity meetings and demonstrations, arresting Solidarity leaders. There are a number of priests who are also arrested in this, thrown into prison without trial. In other words, the whole Helsinki, you know, the Helsinki Accords were simply being ignored by this government. So this is 6 months before the visit of President Reagan. Interestingly enough, 3 weeks before he arrived in Rome, President Reagan signed a directive called the National Security Decision Directive number 32. And this was, at the time, held as secret. It was a directive from the President of the United States to the various elements of the government, and it basically it was a directive to find ways to bring about the end of communism in Poland. Okay. So, Reagan and John Paul II meet. They speak about their worldview, what they think about the Soviet Union, what they think about communism. They're in perfect agreement with all of this. In the process, the Pope says that he has a very clear Vatican foreign policy regarding Eastern Europe, and that is to help the Poles to freedom through the Solidarity Union. President Reagan responds, "We can help." And then at that time, he revealed to the Pope National Directive number 32. So the two of them are right along the same lines. And what happens then is that that in military and political and social intelligence is shared between the United States government and the Vatican. It is the closest relationship we have ever had, and even to this day we don't have that kind of relationship. Now, the 1980s were an incredibly incredible time in which the United States worked closely with the Vatican and the Vatican with the United States in order to share intelligence on what's going on, particularly in Poland itself. There is a very interesting shift that takes place in foreign policy from the Vatican's point of view. It is a realignment with the West, much as it had been with Pius XII. In January of 1984, the United States established full diplomatic relations with the Vatican, with the Holy See, and there was an exchange of ambassadors. The Papal Nuncio to the United States then was designated the ambassador to the United States. This was Archbishop Pio Laghi. And I got to share this with you. There was a moment of in my life in which I actually touched history. It was kind of exciting. Archbishop Pio Laghi was named ambassador to the United States. I was teaching at Christian Brothers University in Memphis at the time. In fact, that particular year, I was not teaching. I was doing administrative work as the vice president for student services. And the president of the college invited the archbishop to Memphis to receive an honorary doctorate. And so anyway, he accepted. And this was the first visit that the Vatican ambassador would make to any place, and they chose Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, my God.
Well, this is the exciting part from my point of view. I got called into the president's office, and he said, "Oh, by the way, you're – department, student services, is in charge of the visit. So, you know, you work with the caterers, with the hospitality, the invitation, the whole works, security, the whole works." So it was just a really exciting moment,
my gosh, yeah.
You know, in my life that Archbishop Pio Laghi came and received this doctorate and all this kind of stuff, and I played a little tiny piece of history there.
Oh, wow. That's exciting.
Yeah, it is kind of exciting. Well, anyway, so you have this report that's been established between Washington and the Holy See. Now let's add to this another individual, and this being the Premier of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev. Now, if you remember back, one of the things that Reagan was always accused of was that he had not sat down, had not met with his Soviet counterpart. And if you remember, his comeback was, "Well, I'd like to, but they keep dying on me." When he was elected in 1980 and took office in 1981, Leonid Brezhnev was a very, very sick man and died shortly after. He was then replaced by Konstantin Chernenko, who died a couple months later. So then they brought in Andropov,
uh-huh,
who died shortly after.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then finally then you had a younger man, Mikhail Gorbachev. And Gorbachev realized that something had to be done. In 1978, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was an absolute disaster. The entire Soviet war machine ground down in this guerrilla war that what we're going to talk about from a different point of view a little bit later on. But it was an absolute disaster. The Soviets, workers were not working, you know, that whole, mm-hmm. that little saying that, you know, we pretend to work while they pretend to pay us is, it was part and parcel. There was another current underway in Eastern Europe that most of us were not aware of. In the 1980s, I had an opportunity to get to know a family in Germany in the area around Cologne, and they had a young son. He was in his late teens, early 20s, and had come to the United States for he spent about six weeks with us, and it was a good opportunity for him to learn some English and me to practice my German and get to know a lot of things. One of the things he told me that was that he had gone on a school trip with his other schoolmates over to East Berlin. Now, I had been to East Berlin myself on one occasion. It was one of the scariest moments, days of my life. It was just, you know, you're living in 1984 under the, you know, this communist thing. That's what they did. They went themselves, and they were shown around like, you know, other tourists, quote unquote, were. But he mentioned that they went into a government building. It was a whole class of 20-year-old West German youngsters and their teacher, and they went into a government building and they couldn't get in. They opened the doors up and they couldn't get into the building, and the East German, their tour guides, quickly went to try to figure out what to do, and as a result, these East German or the West German teenagers happened to be in this lobby with a whole bunch of other teenagers. These are East German teenagers, and they were all sitting on the floor. They had staged a sit-in. And Marcus was describing this because the two sets of teenagers began intermingling.
Oh my God.
And the Westerners are going like, what are you doing? And the Easterners were talking about how disillusioned they were with communism and how this made no sense and it's time for us to change. We have to get into the 20th century and blah, 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 all this. Well, the whole exchange only took place about 20 minutes or so. But Marcus was able to describe an incident that had taken place that I would never have thought could happen in East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in fact, it did. In fact, it was happening all over East Germany, all over Eastern Europe. And Gorbachev knew this.
Okay.
He knew that to save communism, he had to bring communism into the modern world. They were not competing well with the West.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a reality. And so he introduced two Russian words to us. And one of those was perestroika, renewal. Perestroika would be the equivalent in the Catholic Church to aggiornamento, okay? And the other one was that you can't have perestroika, you can't have renewal without glasnost, which is openness. They had to be find themselves open. So as a result, Gorbachev is trying to reform Soviet society. We've seen this any number of times. See, putting a human face on communism. You know, Khrushchev tried to do it. Dubček tried to do it. You know, there are a number of attempts, and this is what Gorbachev is also trying. At the same time, he's trying to maintain Soviet hegemony over Eastern Europe, taking that hard line, and he comes up against a president, Reagan, who is not going to get buffeted about.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have then is a contest of wills that takes place. The Soviets upgrade their intermediate-ranged ballistic missiles in Europe by introducing the SS-20s. They expected Reagan to back down and cry uncle. Instead, what he did was he sent in Pershing 2 missiles, the U.S. equivalents. This was incredibly unpopular in Western Europe, particularly in France and Germany and in Britain. People were very upset about these new missiles coming in. There was, if you remember at the time, also a group known as the Nuclear Freeze Movement, which was trying to encourage the United States and Soviet Union to freeze their missiles and then to begin lowering those. Instead, what happens is it looks as though he's upping the ante. What he's really doing is he's calling the bluff of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, Gorbachev is going to have to recognize this. We have the meetings that take place in Reykjavik in Iceland, first of all in Geneva, then in Iceland. And after they had established a rapport, they personally liked each other, which is an important point.
Yeah.
In fact, Gorbachev was at President Reagan's funeral back in May, June, I think it was in June of 2004. And so they developed a friendship with each other, but they were still playing chess. You know? And at Helsinki, when Reagan walked away from an agreement that Gorbachev had to actually reduce arms, we'll reduce our nuclear weapons if you promise not to develop the Strategic Defense Initiative. And when Reagan walked away from that, everybody thought, oh my goodness, here we go. He's just made the world so much more dangerous. In actuality, he upped the ante, and at that point, Gorbachev folded his hand. And then that's when things really begin changing, mm-hmm. You know. Because Gorbachev is not only dealing with a very strident, militant U.S. president, he's also dealing with a very strident, militant pope.
Right.
You know, after 1981, with the attempted assassination on the part of John Paul II, probably done through the Bulgarian Secret Service, probably backed by the KGB. We don't have a smoking gun on that, but we've got a lot of inferences. What you have, the reaction of the Pope is not to cower. John Paul II is not a coward. He's not going to hide behind inside the Vatican. Mm-hmm. Instead, he goes out and is all the way, 1 year later, he goes to Fatima, mm-hmm. and presents the bullet. You know, and he is absolutely convinced that on this feast of Our Lady of Fatima, he was saved by Our Lady of Fatima. He encourages the underground church in Eastern Europe, particularly in Czechoslovakia and in Lithuania. Remember the fact that he had basically defied Vatican foreign policy concerning closing down these churches. He's actually now, as Pope, he's encouraging those. So they're getting more and more powerful. The Vatican radio is being used to send information, anti-Soviet propaganda, into Eastern Europe. In East Germany, they built a huge radio tower to block out American and Vatican radio waves, and it was a huge television tower itself. And they built this thing, great big round thing. It was in East Berlin. I remember I have a photograph of it that I had taken, and it's so funny because when the sun rises, the sun hits that tower and it forms a huge burning cross.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's the largest cross in Eastern Europe. And the East Germans went up there and they painted it every color they could to try to get the cross off. But every day, you know, God reigned over Eastern Europe. It was just
awesome.
Yeah. And of course, and they were trying to stop the radio transmissions.
Uh-huh.
Well, not only that, but then you have these incredible visits that John Paul II had to Poland, and the Polish government couldn't stop him. They just, you know, it was 1979, 1981, 1983, and in each of these, he has greater and greater influence. Mm-hmm. In each of these. Gorbachev signaled the United States for detente, and he did it through the Vatican. In 1989, he has a meeting, Gorbachev has a meeting with President Bush. This is George Herbert Walker Bush on the island of Malta in order to bring about a lessening of the tensions between the two countries. After that meeting, Gorbachev then went to Rome and had a meeting with the Pope. Now, I mentioned before that with President Reagan, it was the first time a sitting U.S. president had ever visited the Pope. Mm-hmm. This is the first time a Soviet premier is going to visit the Pope. This is absolutely groundbreaking. And there, he promises a closer state-to-state relations, to establish relations with the Vatican. This is the Holy See. This is incredibly difficult for him to pull off domestically, because inside of Russia you have a the Russian Orthodox Church, which is not at all interested, as it's beginning to come out from underneath the heel of atheistic communism. It's going to take, it has a very strong Russian identity, national identity, and so there's a lot of distrust. And so that's going to be very difficult for him to pull off. He promises religious freedom in the East, and in other words, the Helsinki Accord, and then even goes so far as to invite John Paul II to the Soviet Union at a date yet to be determined. Unfortunately for him, for John Paul II, Gorbachev is not going to last long enough, and once again the Russian Orthodox Church is going to pretty much veto that. Gorbachev, along with President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, believed that there would be a day coming soon when Europe could be, and these are their words, a commonwealth of sovereign democratic states. This is quite a statement for a Soviet premier to make, but he believed that it would be, that there would be a commonwealth of sovereign democratic states. And then they also went on to say that these states would be grounded in spiritual values, in pluralism, in religious tolerance, in mutual understanding.
Wow. Gorbachev said that?
Yeah. Isn't that something? This is like 1989. And this is the ideal. And in fact, this has come about, unfortunately, with the exception of the first one missing, that being religious values. The Europe that has been formed together, and in fact, the common market, or the EU, that has been formed together, as they're in the process of putting together the final drafts of their constitution, do not even mention Christianity. Which I don't know how you can do that.
I don't know how you can.
No.
I mean, you can't walk around anywhere in Europe without recognizing the importance of. I mean, I've only been to Italy, but.
Yeah. But no, you're right. You know, you're right. You can't study European history without recognizing the seminal role that the Catholic Church and the Protestant denominations have played in the history of that continent.
Absolutely.
And yet that constitution has done this. So the ideal that Gorbachev, Bush, and John Paul II had has not come about. Of course, you know, two of the three are no longer on the scene.
Right.
But nonetheless, well, then you had a dangerous moment in 1991, and I'll never forget, you know, the night that the red flag, with the hammer and sickle came down over the Kremlin. It was just a normal night. It was no big deal in Russia. They just, you know, pulled it down, and late that night, then they sent up the blue, red, and white flag of Russia. That was in the West. That was Christmas. What a Christmas gift that was. And everything looked as though it was just going to be really wonderful. But then if you remember, while Gorbachev was on vacation, he was arrested by a military coup. The one thing that all Kremlinologists said would never happen happened. The army attempted to overthrow the government because it was liberalizing too quickly. But then if you remember that those events that follow afterwards, the generals who were involved in this coup in Moscow found themselves drunk. They were just so out of their league that some of them had just, they sat down and drank an entire bottle of vodka, you know, just to anesthetize themselves. And so there was no leadership at the top. You had the army go to the government building called the White House. And there Boris Yeltsin comes out, stands on a tank, you know, and he becomes like the hero. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then, you know, you have the demise that takes place of that. The what follows then afterwards is the collapse of the Soviet Union into its various parts. Incredibly important in this, then, in a unipolar world, which we have today, was basically one superpower, the United States. The Vatican continues to play an incredibly important role, although it doesn't have that special relationship that it did under the Reagan administration. In fact, during the first Bush administration, those ties, those intimate ties, were slowly withdrawn. And so the exchange of information back and forth became less intense. Once Poland fell, once Germany was reunited, once Eastern Europe was liberated, and this happened, of course, under the first President Bush. It had actually been set up by President Reagan, but pulled off by President Bush and all. And so there's not that intensity that had taken place before. But regardless, you have an incredibly powerful role that the Vatican continues to play, especially in foreign policy. In 1989, there was a Senate hearing, and the Secretary of State James Baker was appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the chairman of that at the time was Senator Joseph Biden. Uh-huh. And he mentioned to James Baker that his observation that he considered the most important relationship the United States has with any other country as being the Holy See.
Wow.
Isn't that something? You know? And so John Paul II's foreign policy, his basic mission in foreign policy has been toward democracy and spreading democracy throughout the world, the use of qualified, and it's important, qualified capitalism for the good of mankind, for the increase of human rights and social justice. And then just say a couple fast things about the Clinton administration. In 1992, you have a big shift of the government, of course, heading from a Republican to a Democrat, and President Clinton. President Clinton is going to appoint as his ambassador to the Vatican, Ray Flynn, the former mayor of Boston, who has had a long-time relationship with John Paul II. That goes all the way back to when he was Bishop of Krakow. And so there was that relationship that had been built up. Flynn himself referred to the relationship between the United States and the Holy See as more important than any other relationship in the world. And although we have our differences and certainly when it came to the culture of life and the culture of death, discussion between President Clinton and John Paul II, which was poignant from time to time, there were other times in which the two worked closely together on humanitarian crises, particularly in Somalia and in Bosnia. And I think one of the things that's recognized is that the United States has boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, that's we can place more men more quickly and more lethally than any other country in the world. We have that. But the Vatican has a billion members and an incredible network of people that can be tapped for eyes on the ground, ears on the ground. You know, All the PR goes to groups like Doctors Without Borders and Red Cross and all this, but if we had any notion of the incredible humanitarian work that is done by Catholics, either through agencies or individually or within dioceses, it's absolutely phenomenal, and that's something that is worldwide. It's global.
Right.
There's not a spot in the world that the Catholic Church doesn't have some kind of presence.
Service of volunteer or other.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think that's going to continue serving the international community throughout. The Vatican's role on all of that. We're going to be turning our sights to the Middle East now. And as we do that, we're going to see once again the role of the Vatican in this. even in the Muslim world, we shouldn't discount that. Even in the Muslim world, the visits that John Paul II had at the youth conference in Morocco was absolutely phenomenal. He was very well received. A couple years ago, also, he visited Syria and was very well received. These are things that are important to keep in mind. In the Cairo conference concerning population,
wow.
You know, it was the Vatican. Some countries that still consider themselves Christian Catholic countries, mainly South and Central America, and Muslim countries that stood for the family and stood for the inviolability of human life. You know, the traditional Christian, quote-unquote, countries of Western Europe and North America were not there. They were on the other side. And so there is a relationship. But there are great questions also. There's a great challenge concerning Wahhabism, jihadism,
mm-hmm.
a militant Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we do with all of that? And I don't have an answer for that, by the way, because you can't read history in the future tense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to, as we turn our gaze from the Cold War, we turn our gaze to what is undoubtedly the greatest challenge of the early part of the 21st century, and perhaps we can see the Vatican role unfolding in that aspect also.
All right. Okay. Well, Father, can we close with prayer?
Yeah. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.